Morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. If I could reserve 3 minutes.
Sure.
May not even need it. May it please the court, my name is Robert Lichtenstein. I'm appellate counsel for Mr. Becker. I'd like to incorporate the opening brief for the appellant into any arguments that may be forthcoming in the court's consideration. The appellant was charged under Virginia Code Section 18.2456 for misbehavior of an officer in his official character. And, of course, the standard is, I'm sure the Attorney General pointed out, is the evidence most favorable to the Commonwealth. But I think it is clear there is no willful intent to misbehave on the part of Mr. Becker.
Am I correct in reading your assignment of error that this basically comes down to a sufficiency of the evidence case? Whether there's evidence of intent to misbehave.
That's correct. Willful intent to misbehave, Your Honor, is the big part. There's also the court's reliance on what we would argue was impermissible information that was brought in through the, I believe it's called the certificate of the lower court, general district court, presiding order.
Although the circuit court ruled that certificate didn't matter in terms of its...
The court said, it said, I'm specifically relying only on the information before me. Yet, what is interesting is they went all the way back and spent about 6 pages, I think it's JA 80 through 86, discussing the fact that he did not appear in court, which was a totally irrelevant position also. It said, I'm only relying on the garnishment that was sent, which led to premature...
But we typically take trial courts at their word, and my own experience is the courts will often discuss all kinds of issues that come up and then ultimately discard them in terms of what it relies upon for its ultimate conclusion.
Our point is, though, that the court acknowledged early on, because trial counsel brought its attention, that it was concerned about the lower court judges, being the general district court's certificate, included a tremendous amount of, visceral opinion and misfacts, and it brought it to the circuit court's attention. The circuit court said, I have read this. It's one of those examples of the horse getting out of the barn.
Let's come back to the sufficiency issue.
Yes, sir.
We have a case here where a lawyer deliberately sent a judicial document, what would otherwise be a court order had it been signed, to the servicing agent of the employer. And he admitted that he intended the employer's agent to rely on that document and to institute the garnishment proceeding against the debtor. Why isn't that the intent to undermine the authority of the court?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be if that's all he sent, but he actually sent the garnishment package to the Fairfax General District Court to be filed.
He testified that he intended on the employer to rely upon the bogus, the unsigned order of the court.
But not to deduct funds. All he did was to forward the package, a correct package, on a judgment debtor, a garnishment proceeding. He initiated it by sending it to the Fairfax General District Court for filing. Unbeknownst to him, it was not filed.
But he also testified on page 79 of the appendix, he testified that he called ADP, the servicer, and told them that the court would be returning the funds and they were not to send any additional funds. So that seems to me from that testimony.
Once he was made aware. Well, once the checks came in the court, I'm assuming, or the clerk said, the checks are here, and he said, the court said, you don't have an order on it. And he said, well, the court said, I'm sending them back. He said, fine. So what he showed was the intent not to have any further taken out once he was made aware the order was in it.
He intended the employer to rely on that, and he said he did.
He intended the employer.
And not only that, he knew, because it had happened in the past, that employers not only do rely on this, but they start withholding funds.
Well, again, that was unfortunate, But that was a small firm that called up, and I think in the circuit court proceeding, he indicated that he doesn't even know if the funds were received in that case. Often, garnishees would call up and say,
well, wait a minute, I cut off Judge Decker. She had a question a minute ago. Let me let her ask the question.
No, go ahead.
And often they will go ahead and call up. Let's start
with the proposition that the trial court didn't believe a whole lot the attorney said.
Considering that was the only evidence that was presented, I would think that they would give due credits to that since it was unimpeached.
Well, here's what troubles me. Maybe you can address this. Your client does what we've already discussed, and basically his defense is, well, it was clearly marked as a courtesy copy. Therefore, I'm off the hook. And yet, against that, we have his testimony that he intended the employer to rely on it. We have the fact that at some point, I don't remember exactly what the point in time was off the top of my head without looking it up, but I think he testified to something to the effect of, well, he's doing all this because it takes so long to work through the courts, and the implication of all that seems to be by doing all this, the employer is sending the money in and he can get it sooner rather than wait for the court to actually issue an order. And, I mean, the district court and the circuit court as well took a dim view of an officer of the court basically making an end run around hearings and proceedings and sign court orders to accomplish something for the benefit of their client.
Well, I would take exception with the characterization, Judge. He only sent the courtesy copy of that sheet, which does not imply that they should take any affirmative action in sending the funds. The garnishment is not signed by the clerk or the judge. He sent a blank one down there so that they would initiate the logistics of putting the garnishment
in place,
but not taking out the funds until they receive it.
Counsel, that's not clear from the record, though. Our point is that the trier of fact is entitled to make reasonable inferences from the evidence. And in the evidence, you have what appears to be an order. And there's nothing that qualifies it or that clarifies anything. So while the arguments you're making to us now are arguments you can make to the trier of fact, and the trier of fact can reach those inferences or reach other inferences based on intent and other elements of the crime, but at this juncture, we can't.
Well, on the sufficiency, Judge, the court can look at it and see that he did not basically ask the third-party entity, actually the garnishee is the employer who hired ADP. ADP is a national, one of the largest national firms that deals with payroll. This wasn't a mom-and-pop store as mischaracterized by the general district court judge and even maybe referenced to by the circuit court judge. This wasn't a small firm calling up saying, what do I do? And then he directed them, as he indicated in his testimony, to talk to counsel. This is a huge, one of the largest, and I put the references in the brief of 625,000 businesses and Fortune 500 companies and all these different matters. That's their job. The problem rests with ADP, not with Mr. Becker.
What was his purpose in sending the garnishment form to ADP?
To alert them that a garnishment would be forthcoming, that they could set it up. There's a tremendous amount of logistical paperwork, I would imagine, in setting up a garnishment.
He could essentially send a letter to that effect.
Well,
then he sends an unsigned court order, which, there's no. I assume ADP doesn't employ a platoon of lawyers to process all these things when they come in. So you get some clerk who reads this thing, and it looks like a court order. The fact that it's not signed, but I mean, it orders withdrawal of funds.
It had a return date, it had a case number, it had all the things that would ordinarily be assigned by the attorney when he files the paperwork.
Who files the case number?
The case number, actually, from my understanding, speaking of Mr. Becker, was the underlying judgment case. And what happens in most of the jurisdictions is once you request a garnishment, they take that number and they add a suffix, a suffix to it, either 01, 02, 03, because some people have multiple judgments, and then that's assigned back. So he didn't take anything that was wrong in this.
Let me go back to the question I had. You said that he intended them, ADP, to set up, I think was your term, the garnishment process, correct?
Yes.
That's something that ADP would normally do when they received the signed garnishment order from the court, correct?
I believe so, but after great delay.
So what he intended ADP to do was to start the garnishment process on their end prior to the court actually having issued the garnishment.
But not to take the money. It was not his intent.
But where is that in the record? Where is that in terms of evidence in the record?
I can find the judge.
Well, just tell us what.
Well, my understanding was he indicated it was never his intent that ADP would take the money out. They've dealt with him in the past.
So that was before the trier of fact, who had the opportunity to make a determination on
whether to believe that or not. The honors took a dim view of that, and I think he was more explicit.
They're entitled to reject that testimony if they want to.
But there was no evidence to the contrary of what the testimony was. He was the only one who gave testimony.
Well, the evidence was the document itself that went to the company.
Which said
nothing. Evidence.
It said nothing. It's a blank document. I could.
It wasn't a blank document, except for being signed. It was a court order ordering the withholding of funds.
But it was ineffectual because it was not signed. Nor was any action advocated by Mr. Becker that imparted the need for ADP to prematurely take the funds out. It prematurely took the funds out. And when Mr. Becker was alerted, he immediately took the corrective actions to go ahead and inform both the employer, who then referred him to ADP, and he took care of everything he could to correct it. I think the intent, again, Judge, it's the willful intent to misbehave. I think the intent was pure in this case, but the execution was lousy. If he had put in the complimentary letter, do not take any further action until you receive the order.
Right, and he's a lawyer, and he sent this before he actually even filed the original documents.
His office pretty much sent it.
So doesn't the trier of fact have the ability to make a reasonable assessment of all that and believe that there was impure intent?
But what my question is, what was the impure intent? He didn't say send the money to me. He didn't say send it to my client. It was being forwarded to the court. All he wanted to do was to ask ADP to put the process in motion, not to take the money
and
out.
And that is something ADP was not obligated to do until the court sent the official document.
Again, it goes back to ADP.
No, it doesn't go back to ADP. It goes back to your client trying to get the process, i.e. the payment of garnishment, done earlier. The only reason it fell apart is because it was an out-of-state employer and the garnishment never issued. It's almost like trying to withdraw funds before the check clears. That's the deposit. I mean, setting the garnishment in process is part of the garnishment procedure.
Judge, all I can say is I think his intent was not there. The willful intent to misbehave in his official character was not there. He never signed anything. He never signed the complimentary letter. He never signed any of the garnishment summons. Basically, that was sent from his office, and contemporaneously, too, he forwarded the documents to the court. It had not effectively been filed.
But he's responsible for what's filed under his name.
I would agree, Judge, except this is a criminal, and it's got to be beyond a reasonable standard. Right. I could understand if it was someone in my office who missed a statute of limitations, and that's a civil in nature. Yes, as captain of the ship, I am responsible. But here we're imposing criminal sanctions. He received active jail sentence for this, Judge. He actually received a punishment. I would hope that it would be imposed upon him to have some affirmative action that would have initiated a premature withdrawal. It was unbeknownst to him that the court did not file this.
Was there any argument made at either the trial court or on brief that he was not responsible for the acts of his legal assistant?
I referenced it, Judge, that he didn't sign anything.
I understand
that. I don't know if I said it was not.
Was it argued at the trial court, or was it assigned error in this court?
I don't think it was argued in the trial court from my reading of the various transcripts. I did reference that he never signed anything, Judge, I guess by implication.
But you didn't assign error to, to him being convicted.
I did not assign error that he himself did not sign. I noted it that he didn't sign it, and I think that went to the weight of the evidence. I understand it's in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, but you still have to show the willful intent. The willful intent is the key to this. And again, there's nothing signed by him. There's no directive by either the paperwork or anything that was requesting that they take an affirmative act to take money out of that account prematurely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Your time is up. All right, Mr. Carter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please support Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth? The defendant in this case, his intentional forwarding of misleading paperwork demonstrated disrespect for the court and its processes.
Suppose he had just written a letter and said, I have filed for garnishment in the district court. You will soon be receiving a copy of that. Please institute whatever process is necessary to withhold funds as soon as you receive that garnishment order. Would that have been okay?
I think that would have been appropriate, Your Honor. And I think there's a distinction in this case. If you look, the letter that was sent to the garnishee is at appendix page 1, and the cover letter that was sent to the trial court in this matter is at appendix page 4. And the letter that was sent to the trial court says, you know, enclosed, please find a suggestion and summons for garnishment and a check. It's indicating that we're filing this proceeding right now. The letter that was sent to the employer says, attached is a complimentary copy of a garnishment summons for, list the name, social security number, the filing date, which at that point it was an expected filing date, although it's not indicated on the paperwork, case number and return date, and as the court has noted, a garnishment summons form, which is a pre-printed form, which looks for all intents and purposes like the actual form. The only thing that's missing there is the clerk's signature.
I'm assuming he actually got those forms from the court.
Yes, sir. I believe they're also available online. You can download them from the Virginia Supreme Court website, but there is no evidence in the record to say where they came from.
Counsel, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that it was an unsigned order?
Well, Your Honor, it was an unsigned order. However, the defendant in this case, the trial court could have held him to intend the logical consequences of his actions. What he did in this case was he sent this order, which for all intents and purposes looks like an actual order, complete with filing date, case number, return date, to the garnishment debtor in a manner that he knew in previous circumstances had misled other garnishees to go ahead and start signing funds. And he sent this to them before he checked to make sure it had been even filed with the court, much less issued. Because in this case, the garnishment was rejected for improper service. So the defendant in this case knowingly sent out all that information without checking back. And the logical consequence of those actions was exactly what happened in this case. The employer began withholding funds in reliance on his paperwork.
So if I understand your argument correctly, it's he was aware that the sending of these unsigned garnishment orders resulted in prepayment of the funds, if you will, in other cases, which ultimately were not a problem because the garnishment was ultimately issued. But here the house of cards came tumbling down when the garnishment wasn't issued.
Yes, Your Honor. And to be fair to the appellant, I believe there was only one other case referenced in the record where this had happened before. But it had happened in the past, and he used the exact same manner of proceeding in this case to forward it on. The trial court, looking at the documents in this case, found that the documents were misleading and a layperson would have been misled by them. Again, we're looking at a general district court form. It's pre-printed. It looks exactly as it would if it had been actually issued by the court.
What is the real issue here, whether he intended the payment company to rely on that and take some affirmative actions to institute the garnishment process? I mean, it certainly can't be contempt simply to send a courtesy copy of an order that you expect to be entered by a judge or at a later date.
Yes, Your Honor. I think here the issue is that the defendant took a shortcut to expedite the garnishment process. The court's process was taking too long, so he took it upon himself to act. And the general district court found, and I believe the circuit court adopted that ruling, that he was acting under color of authority from the court. Although the paperwork was not signed, he was submitting this paperwork straight through. And he was doing it to expedite the garnishment process and to try and get a garnishment in a quicker time than he would if he was using the court's process, which is
He wanted the money withheld beginning the very day that ADP received the court's garnishment order, instead of a week later while they had to set up their computer process or whatever.
Presumably, Your Honor. However, what he did was he sent this paperwork out before knowing whether the court had accepted his garnishment for filing or had entered it. So in this case, that pleading was rejected altogether. It may have been the mechanism by which he was caught, but I believe the disrespect for the court and its processes is in the kind of intentional shortcut there. It's how we get to that end result. And as the court noted, the trial court heard the defendant testify, sitting as the fact finder in this case. They are entitled to make a credibility determination regarding his stated motives. And this court held in Robinson that a defendant's assertion of good faith can be overcome by other circumstances in the record. And the trial court was certainly entitled to infer his intent from his actions rather than believe his trial testimony in that regard.
It appears that this proceeding in the circuit court involved the taking of evidence the district court. It involved taking of evidence that didn't occur in the presence of the judge. That'd be fair?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is not a summary contempt. That being the case, the circuit court received the certificate of summary contempt from the district court. Tell me why that hasn't affected the process or require reversal.
Well, Your Honor, preliminarily, the evidence that was admitted in circuit court, it contained relevant evidence. It was the general district court had a hearing, and that certification incorporated the transcript from that hearing. It also incorporated the operative documents that we're working on here. The only portion of that certification coming in that the defendant objected to were the opinions of the general district court in its ruling, and also the general district court's improper reference to the defendant's disciplinary record.
And in fact, I think the Commonwealth had objected that it agreed with the defendant that it was inappropriate for the court to rely on that.
Correct,
I think the court indicated that it was not going to do so.
Correct. The trial court did indicate that, as Your Honor's mentioned, that it was not going to consider that disciplinary record, that it was inappropriate at this stage of the proceedings. And the trial court also, on multiple occasions, reiterated that it understood that it was making an independent assessment of these actions based on the record before it, independent of the general district court's opinions, which were contained in the certification. So the defendant in this case essentially got what he wanted. He made an objection to the trial court. The trial court said, "You're right, I'm not going to consider those objectionable pieces of information." And trial courts, unlike juries, are uniquely situated to take all that information in and disregard what's admissible and what's not admissible. And we have to assume on appeal the trial court did so in this case, particularly where he was demonstrating that he was more than aware of his obligation to do so. Furthermore, Your Honor, I believe you pointed out earlier as well that the court stated in closing that even absent the certification, he would have reached the exact same opinion. So we have a harmless error argument here as well. So even if that certification did not come in, the trial judge has stated his opinion would not have changed. So even if it was error to bring that certification in, the particular parts that were offensive were not considered by the judge. In any event, the entire thing didn't impact his decision in this matter. If I can answer any further questions from the court, I'd be happy to. Thank
okay.
you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, we'll come down to Greek Council, take up Miller versus. I'm sorry?
Do you have rebuttal?
No, Eustace's rebuttal.